everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. Bringing new ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Exciting stuff we're talking about, isn't it? Let's go into it. Let's kind of tell people. I want you today, you're going to get an angle about addiction, something that's going to help you understand addictions. When does excess become too much? When does doing become overdoing? Well, we use the criteria. How does it affect you in these different kind of ways? Is there any other way of knowing? What makes an excess a compulsion, you know? Well, here's a simple answer. Who's driving the car? Who's in charge? Let me teach you about a lot from what I've learned from my own history as being a cigarette smoker, right? I remember when I was a cigarette smoker and I was trying to stop. And I remember this amazing phenomenon when it was the early period of time when people just discovered cigarettes may be not healthy. And so somebody would say to me, you know, maybe you should stop smoking. And I would say, well, let's think about it. And I noticed at that moment I was lighting a cigarette that any discussion about stopping smoking always was accompanied by my lighting a cigarette. Well, this is kind of interesting. I wondered who lit that cigarette. I noticed, I never mentioned it to anyone, but every time anyone ever talked about stopping smoking, I was literally lighting a cigarette. I had a cigarette in my hand. So I would test myself, and then somebody else would come over and say, oh, you know, the cigarette smoking, they're finding out it's related to cancer. Boom, cigarette in my hand. Where did that come from? How did it get there? And I began to realize somebody owns my brain. Somebody else is in charge here. Somebody's lighting these cigarettes. I know it's me. I know I could look for the matches. I knew I was carrying the pack in my pocket. But who was in charge? Because I would see it happen, and I would feel the seduction. And so I went and I learned. I learned about my romance. And here's how I see addiction. I see excesses as romance, as love. As the best love you'll ever have in your life. Listen, you love to shop, you love to smoke, you love to drink. Think about it. You and that thing. It may not be a man or a woman specifically, but it is a romance. And as I see it, cigarettes are to people, and if you know people who smoke, you're going to see romantic people. Because what happens with cigarettes? You pick up this thing. It's there whenever you want it. Usually, it's accompanying a meal. You know, you have a meal and then you smoke a cigarette afterwards. Or after sex, you smoke a cigarette. So it's there when you have sex. It's there when you eat. It's there when you wake up in the morning. It's there at night. But it doesn't nag. It doesn't give you advice. It doesn't blame you. It doesn't do anything bad. It is the best romance. You want to throw it away, you just throw it away. You want to pick it up, you just think pick it up. Now, think about your excess. Think about the thing you love in life, your video game. You turn on your game and you shoot your game. It's you and the video game are having a romance. It's almost sexual in the passion that you have with it. Think about alcohol, that first shot of alcohol, that burning feeling of the straight alcohol, the scotch or the rye, going down your gullet, and you feel that burn followed by that warmth, or the cold beer. That wonderful, exquisite feeling of that beer going down and you feel the mellowness going over you. Or you get dressed and you go out shopping. And you're now in this thing called shopping. You won't see it as an addiction, but your feet are automatically going to the stores and you're looking at the shoes and you're looking at the purses and the bags. And you're now in a shopping thing. It's a romance. Or eating. You get a box of Entenmann chocolate cakes and you bring them home. And you sit down with your cookies or your cakes and you turn on the TV and you are in love. You are having a romance. You are having you and these things are in your mouth. Anybody who loves anybody who has an addictive behavior, are you in love with someone who does excesses? You're in a menage a trois. They have a better romance with that thing than they have with you. And there's very little you could do about it. Don't blame yourself. The romance is very potent. It's very powerful because they can get it at will. They could pick it up whenever they want. They can't discard you. but they could discard it. You could even step on a cigarette and it's not going to yell at you. Armand DeMille here, talking about romance. In order to learn about why someone goes to excess, why someone has addictions, you have to learn about how they love and the disappointments in their loves. And the more disappointments you have in loving regular humans, the more risk there is, the more pain there is, the more danger there is, the more you're going to find some inanimate substance appealing to you. Alcohol, drugs. I had a kid once walk in. He walked into my office. He sat with me, and this is when Andrew Tatarsky was running a cocaine consultation program out of the DeMille Center. And this young boy walks in, and he says to me, my mother's a hooker. She's on the streets. She's getting every day. She's bringing a man home. And I'm in the room next door listening to her get screwed by some stranger who's given her money. He says, we have no money. She gives the money right over to a pimp. We have no money. We have little food. I have no father. And every now and then I get beat by somebody. And then I go to and I find the crack pipe. He said, and I light up the crack and I take that in and all of the pain is gone. And he said to me right to my face, what could you give me better than that? And I understood. Love is in the substance. If that's where you're going to feel safe, if that's where you're going to settle in, that's what you have to learn about. You have to learn about a person's relationship to the thing, and you can't beat it. I'm sorry, no matter who you are. I remember one woman who said to a man, she actually did this. This man was smoking, and she disagreed with his smoking, and she said, hey, you want something to suck on? And she took off a blouse, and she said, cigarettes are like breasts. Have the breast. He said, no, I want the cigarette. No, the cigarette doesn't come with the attachment. No, the cigarette doesn't come with your aggression. No, let's think about what we're looking for. So if you're in a relationship, and let's say you are an abuser, a user to excess, well, then you're in a menage a trois. You have this other relationship. And like I said, out of my own addictions, I have seen in my life that when somebody wants to take it away, it takes over and says, no, no, keep my honey where she is or where he is or where it is. You might even find that your excess is exactly the same excess that your mother or father had. You very often will find, for example, in cigarette smoking, you'll find that your parents were smokers. And this is your way of loving them through the substance they abused, you know, and finding that attachment. So this is Armand DeMille taking a romantic journey with you for a moment on what I think it's about. And in this place, if you understand it, you begin to know. K-N-O-W, know. You got to know where you stand in life. And sometimes we stand at the edge of a precipice and we're about to jump and we just got to know what we're jumping into and know what we're leaving. You might say, you stand on the ledge of life, and that all of life is to know your ledge. No ledge. Knowledge. Just say no.
Make me smile with my heart. Oh.
Why everything that's supposed to be bad make me feel so good? Everything they told me not to is exactly what I would. Man, I tried to stop, man, I tried the best I could, but
you make me smile.
What's your addiction? Is it money? Is it girls? Is it I've been afflicted by not one, not two, but all three. She's got the same thing about me, but more about us. She's coming over, so I guess that means I'm a drug. Just let me peek now, I mean, dang, I'm so curious. She's got a lover, so the lies and the lust is a rush. Time's of the essence, I need you to be spontaneous. Roll up the doja, Henny and Coca-Cola. Then I'm coming over, cause it's never over. Why everything that's supposed to be bad make me feel so good? Everything they told me not to is exactly what I would. I tried to stop, man, I tried the best I could, but
you make me smile.
I see the emotion in your eyes that you try not to show. We get the closest when you high or you drunk or you blow. So I'll pour the potion so we can both get high as we can go. Then I'll get the lotion and do something to me when your thighs is exposed.
Why everything is supposed to be bad make me feel so good? Everything they told me not to is exactly what I would. Man, I tried to stop, man, I tried the best I could, but
make me smile.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you truth in radio.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Let's shift our attention to a different subject. Well, today we're going to talk about something, you know, that's kind of interesting. And we have in the studio with us Jonathan Berent. Jonathan, B-E-R-E-N-T, who has authored a book called Beyond Shyness, approaching a very interesting subject, one that has much more prevalence than most people imagine, because social phobia, or it's related to shyness, we're going to kind of go into this. You know, the person who's sitting in their room playing on their computer over and over again, repeating the game, a number of other things, another of other symptoms, things that you wouldn't imagine, but you wouldn't imagine because these people stay out of reach. Stay out of reach. They're just not available to us because we don't see them because they stay home. And basically, one of the major things we're talking about is the people who stay home. There's another sign of it, which is also has to do with, you know, inability to do certain things beyond going to work and so on and so forth. But let me introduce Jonathan. Jonathan, welcome to WBAI.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you here. Let's just take a look at some of the things that are manifested. Let's talk about computer playing for a minute, and we're going to go right back. Symptoms or the kind of people or the things that people have that you know, people who do have a severe case of social phobia what might also be there, like selective mutism. Give me a list of them just so people should hear.
But there are many different examples of social anxiety. A woman comes into my office in Great Neck, says she's an ovarian cancer survivor, says to me with very genuine words, "Jonathan, I'd rather be back in chemotherapy than speak in front of a group." Fear of public speaking is the number one phobia in the country. A specific example of social phobia. School phobia is another. You mentioned selective mutism.
Let's talk about school phobia for a minute. What is school phobia?
School phobia is anxiety getting out of hand to the point that the person in question avoids school. It's school refusal. Here we have a combination of an anxiety problem along with a profound parenting difficulty. The parents have really lost control when school phobia kicks in.
Mm-hmm. How about selective mutism?
Selective mutism, originally thought of as being rare, but we see a great deal of it. There's nothing organically or physically wrong with the person. The anxiety manifests itself by the person, usually a child, not speaking, not being verbal outside of the family. And if this is not corrected in childhood, it can turn into a very serious problem.
Almost all of these signs of shyness in childhood are additive, aren't they? They're cumulative.
The social anxiety and social phobia, otherwise known as severe shyness, is an additive problem, meaning it gets worse over time. The biggest singular mistake that is made is parents and professionals say when they see patterns of social avoidance, leave little Johnny, leave little Sally alone, they'll grow out of the problem. More often than not, it gets worse over time.
So we're going to go into all of these. How about involuntary virginity?
That's a term I coined. What this refers to are adults who are virgins who wish they were not, and the reason they are is because of performance and anxiety issues related to intimacy.
They can't get out there at all. I mean, they just can't get out. They won't even go out. They won't socialize. If you won't socialize, I guess.
Well, many are paralyzed, but then we have the situation of the young, and this is fairly common, the young adult who says, "I'm going to lose my virginity," and goes to an escort. And 12 escorts later becomes dependent. but is unable to effect any intimacy with a non-escort.
Armand DeMille here, Jonathan Berendt. We're talking about shyness and social phobia. What is shyness?
My way of thinking, shyness is social anxiety. The question is how much of it is present. And it's important to look at it in terms of an attitude, an emotion, and very often it can turn into a physiological reaction. For example, many people who have severe shyness and social anxiety experience panic attacks in the situations that they find frightening, whether it's intimacy, dating, socializing in general, dealing with an authority figure. So they learn to avoid those situations at all costs. That's where the word phobia comes into play.
Wait a minute. Let's back it up. I asked a simple question. What is shyness? Is shyness the person who has their eyes cast down, and they don't like to talk to people, and they don't like to look at people directly in the eyes? What we consider a shy person, it's a person who doesn't want to look at anybody, who's kind of meek around the office. Is that shyness?
That can be a form of it, but the problem is that shyness is a very misunderstood concept in our society.
That's why I'm asking you about it.
That's why the title of my book is Beyond Shyness. We've got to get past it. The problem is it's too abstract. That's why people have a hard time changing. So if you take shyness and you understand it, that it really is social anxiety, which is the way you think, the way you behave, emotions, and it turns into a lifestyle, if you know concretely what it is, then you've got more power to change. The problem is shyness becomes a problem when the person in question starts avoiding. That's the key word. I refer to it as the addiction to avoidance. When you have to avoid things you don't want to be avoiding or you shouldn't be avoiding, it's a problem. Or when you're experiencing too much panic or uncomfortability because of anxiety, it's a problem.
Why won't you come to the party? I'm just a little shy. Right? I never like to go to parties because I'm shy. Are we talking about the right thing?
Well, you're on the right track, but the person who can get to the party, even if he or she is feeling anxiety, is doing a lot better than the person who has to avoid it.
And never goes to the party.
That's for sure. A 20-year-old contacts me on the internet from California. Jonathan, you got to help me. My life is hell. I feel like killing myself. I can't get girls. A month later, he tells me he got an award as the most social incoming freshman in his fraternity. Strange, I thought. What's the answer? Six-pack therapy.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people self-medicate. Alcohol, by far and away, is the drug of choice.
Alcohol becomes the one that takes away the fears that alcohol is one. Of course, the medical profession has others, which we'll talk about as well. Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about social phobia, social anxiety, shyness. When somebody's very young, Jonathan, right, is there kids, in their preteen, are there warning signs? Are there things that tell you this might be trouble?
Yes. The earliest we can do is go back to early childhood. A lot of organizations, for example, have programs called Mommy and Me programs. One of the first things to look for is when there is excessive anxiety when separating. That's your first cue. Intense anxiety in new situations in general, social situations specifically. When there's an absence of peer relationships, when there's difficulty with social skills. And one variable that I have seen that I don't see in any other research is about 50% of the 15,000 people that I have worked with over time have had some kind of a learning disability, a hidden handicap, the brain's difficulty in processing information. The key here is that the person who has the learning disability, whether it's the investment banker who makes $500,000 or the person with a pervasive problem, a developmental problem, they are more susceptible to mistakes and failure at an early age, hence anxiety, hence the need to avoid. And this brings in the role of the parents, which is crucial, who very often mistake nurturing for rescuing. They take on the child's anxiety, and they make it too okay for the person to avoid what's threatening.
Also kind of interesting is the avoidance of sports and being clumsy and being people who can't – they never seem to be on a team for any reason or other, you know, not even – you know, and there's something about their physical body not being out there that kind of talks about an embarrassment or the setting for an embarrassment, no?
Yes and no. Many of the teenagers and adults that I work with can reflect back and identify many humiliating, embarrassing situations because they were not good in sports. However, I'm remembering one patient who was a one of the world's best track and field athletes in high school. He tackled a Heisman Trophy winner four times in a football game, and he was debilitated by social phobia.
If a person is social phobic, and they are social phobic, and they have this thing, I mean, it's kind of like a horrible felt sense. If you sit at home, and you're sitting home, what do you go through in your mind? What do you say to yourself? What's it like to not go out? What's it like to feel frozen by it, you know? What's it like to be a social phobic who stays at home and never goes out, who gets invited out, who has become all of these things, you know, who has just lived the social phobic life? What are they saying to themselves?
Well,
what's their mind like?
If you're talking about the extreme, which you're bordering on agoraphobia here, which is caused often by social phobia, uh-huh. But that person is involved with a lot of self-hatred, shame, humiliation.
What do you mean involved with self-hatred? What do you mean? I mean, that you know, to you as a professional, that makes sense.
Terrible, terrible self-esteem. They don't like themselves. They don't accept themselves. They can't expose themselves. That's the key word. They can't expose themselves to anyone. They're very often depressed and very often involved with delusional thinking, like, my mom and dad will be here forever. I'll never really have to date. I'll never have to work. I mean, this is the extreme. And then what happens is the dependence is bred. It gets worse and worse over time.
The thing that does happen, in their minds, they are saying to themselves, one of the primary symptoms is, if I go out there, I am going to get embarrassed. I am going to be shamed. Now, let's talk about the importance, because in my work with social phobia, shame has been the key element you have to deal with. You have to deal with this sense that I am going to be embarrassed by myself. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. It is the shame, humiliation, and embarrassment that have become toxic that rule people with social anxiety.
So a person who is a social phobic or have social anxiety to the extreme, which is why we're calling it social phobia, would be a person who is saying to themselves, I am going to embarrass myself. I'm going to be out there and I'm going to make a fool of myself is the word I hear them use a lot. I'm going to make a fool of myself. I'm going to say something stupid. I'm going to do something. I'm going to make something happen that will bring shame on me. They believe in some way that they have, each time they go out, there's a potential scene where they're going to be mocked by some person or by a group of people who are going to look at you and laugh at you because you left your fly open or because you dropped a drink on the floor or because something like that. It's that feeling of dread of people's judgment of you that is most characteristic of true social phobia. Isn't that right?
That is correct. I'll give you a quick example of someone who is in the process of curing the problem. Very gifted salesman. When he was a child, his parents gave him the message, a toxic message. Father was an alcoholic. If you're not good in sports, it means you're homosexual. So he struck out all the time in Little League. Then he started experimenting in homosexuality. He would have panic in certain group presentations. Now, there were two levels of this. One is, oh, they can see I'm not okay. They can see I'm nervous. Level two, which was deeper, oh, not only can they see I'm nervous, they can see my thinking. Now, this is a little strange, but what this guy had to do was he had to come to grips with his subjective assessment of an internal flaw. He had to say to himself, even though he was married for the second time, 20% of me needs homosexual stimulation via pornography. Once he accepted that and he did not question his overall identity, he was able to move in the direction of a cure. But the moral of the story there was self-acceptance in terms of what previously he thought of was a dramatic flaw.
This is Armand DeMille with Jonathan Berendt. We're exploring social anxiety, shyness, social phobia. It could be anything from one degree to another. It could be even the smallest amount of it to the large crippling amount where it goes to agoraphobia, where you're afraid to even go out at all. You can't even leave your house. Jonathan, it's always seemed to me, every time I've seen a man with social anxiety, there was a thing that happened in teenage years. Most people, let's start with the beginning. Does most social anxiety and shyness at that level, let's say social anxiety, does that happen before preteen or is it during the teenage years? What is the timing of it?
It usually starts in childhood, but a key thing to look for is during adolescence, if you're not part of a peer group, despite whatever rationalization is there, and usually there's a lot of that, if you're not part of a peer group, there is a serious problem. It gets worse and worse over time. Now, I'll give you an example. People with social anxiety experience trauma. Trauma is a relative phenomenon. For one person, it's going to war. For another person, it's being embarrassed. The lead example I gave, the ovarian cancer survivor who would rather be back in chemotherapy than speak in front of a group, when she was in the 10th grade in Spanish class, the teacher calls on her. She gets in front of the class. She blushes, which is a very debilitating symptom because you can't hide it. The teacher says, "Oh my, look, you're blushing." She freaks. That was trauma. That was not the cause of the social anxiety. There were a lot of family dynamics going on that really caused it. But that was the trauma that put her over the edge and where she became phobic.
I remember most men, as I would work with this again, because I did have some experience working with this in a clinical setting. There's a thing that happens to young men a lot. And one thing that happens to young men a lot, you know, you keep wondering about this embarrassment. What is this you're going to embarrass yourself? What is this you're going to embarrass yourself? Why does somebody have an inordinate sense of embarrassing themselves and making a fool out of themselves? Well, with men, there's kind of an interesting thing. You will generally find that you could trace back a time when they actually had where they remember what it was like to have have erections, spontaneous erections in class. And what it was like, and most men will remember this, what it was like to walk around trying to carry your books in front of you to hide the erection that was coming up around age 14 and 15 and 13. And how some people would be called up to the front of a class. And when they became anxious, they would get an erection. Now, this kind of thing, you know, the happening to a young man could be so traumatic, especially since he is so shamed about sex in the first place. You know, now, whether or not anybody ever brings it to his attention, the dread of being caught being a sexual being could be enough to drive this down, especially if the family has big issues around sexuality. What do you think?
I think that's one example of what can be trauma, and it's based on humiliation and embarrassment, and it's based on not having control. When we have an anxiety disorder, whether it's fear of people or fear of elevators, we're struggling for control, and it's a very desperate struggle. And when people feel nervous, they overreact. A lot of people get panic. They misinterpret what's going on. They press internally. Like, for example, it's very common when you're speaking in front of a group that you're going to feel a little nervous. You're going to feel a little energy, or you're going on a first date, or you're meeting somebody new. People with social anxiety, when they feel this flow of energy, which in essence is an adrenaline flow, they put a negative value judgment on it. They push too hard. It exacerbates it. It often turns into panic.
What do you mean they push too hard?
They don't accept. They don't accept the flow of energy. They say there's something wrong with me. I'm not okay enough.
Because I'm nervous, there's something wrong with me. Because I'm nervous, I'm being a phony. Because I'm nervous, I'm not real. Because I'm nervous, there's something wrong with me because I could feel it.
Well, because I'm nervous, somebody's going to see me, and then I'll be humiliated, and that'll be horrific.
So what I do is I've got to hide that because there's something wrong with me. And so what the alternative to that is, hey, I'm nervous. You know, I'm nervous. That's it. It's okay to be nervous. That makes sense. It's the people who put the judgment on the physiological response. I think that's very important, Jonathan, and a real contribution for people to understand. If you feel something in a situation that is a tension situation, and then you judge yourself for what you feel, that in itself will bring you into this frightened zone. I mean, it could just build on itself.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a short break, play you a little music, and when we come back, we'll continue with our discussion. This is Armand DeMille back with you with A Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Question, do you think people are born with social phobia?
I think there's a genetic predisposition to everything in life, but the worst mistake that anybody can make is to say, oh my God, I was born this way, there's nothing I can do about it. I take a simple example. A woman has panic attacks and depression. Her mother did, and her grandmother did. Yet she learns to control the problem about 95% through psychotherapy, biofeedback, whatever. The moral of the story is you can compensate for a genetic predisposition.
Isn't it, wouldn't you say, that in almost every case of severe shyness or in social anxiety, we got parents who maybe could have done things better. How's that for easy enough? I don't want to blame them, but made mistakes, didn't recognize it early enough, didn't pay attention to it, made too little of it, or put additional pressures on the child, don't you think?
We're into a very important and controversial issue here. You know, when I was first writing my book and the publisher was Simon & Schuster, they said, why are you writing? You're writing about shyness. Why do you have a chapter about parents? Very simple. If I didn't know how to work with parents, I never would have had a practice. There are two types of people with social anxiety and shyness. One is the independent adult who's capable of demonstrating initiative in the process of wellness. The other, whether the person is 40 or 14, is incapable. They're so stuck with avoidance. They're paralyzed. This is because of parenting issues. Parents, not to parent bash as you said, but just to approach this from a cognitive perspective, most of social anxiety is learned. A great deal of the problem with social avoidance and social anxiety is because parents did not learn what to do. And I have to tell you, my biggest frustration clinically is when I meet kids or young adults who have the potential to get well, but their parents are so unhealthy that they're not able to follow through on their part of the clinical program.
You know, in many ways, I think sometimes it really serves the family, as you and I know both as family workers, you know. It could sometimes serve the family to have a child who's a social phobic because it kind of insulates the family. It keeps the child at home. And when you've got a family that's focused on the one sick member, everybody in the family could avoid whatever they have to face on their own. So very often, the social phobic child is the glue of the family.
That can be. So what about this? We have a 32-year-old who is one of these 50-an-hour-a-week on the internet people. He comes into my room, my office.
He's 50
hours a week on the internet.
Okay.
Can't have eye contact, no social skills, no peer relationships. Made $30,000 in one day doing a very sophisticated maneuver on the internet, but absolutely no social life. When it came time for his first therapy session, he locked himself in the bathroom overnight because of his anxiety. Now you have two choices there. Either the anxiety takes control, or you teach the parents how to do some tough love to get control back. And a lot of parents are paralyzed with that concept.
We're going to go to tough love a little later on. Shyness, submissiveness. Good, Jonathan, you're smiling.
Because I knew you were going to say it.
Yeah, but
many people with social anxiety are submissive because they're not proactive in life. But let me tell you a sex story. One woman who was in my practice when she first came could not leave the house without her mother because of anxiety. She became an exotic dancer. When she was an exotic dancer, she was an involuntary virgin. Hard to imagine. But she was able to work for a couple of years and save some money and, you know, really go on her way without putting a value judgment on what she was doing. But what made me think of it is she was able to become proactive through her sexuality and therefore was able to resolve a great deal of her anxiety.
Well, let's look at it for a minute, too, and I'm sure, Roberta, you have something to say about it as well. Submissive behavior, sexually submissive behavior, right? Mm-hmm. The person who prefers, who actually chooses to be more the recipient than the aggressor, okay? Now that goes along with this shyness, demureness, not almost the mutism, which is welcome. So somebody will hunt up a dominant man. And they will hunt up by, you know, being there and making themselves available too, or a dominant woman, because that for some reason they are getting their social anxiety And one level is being celebrated. It's like being, it's like taking them to everything they want. So you're socially anxious. This way you don't have to go out. You get owned by somebody. So a woman owns this man, and this man becomes her slave, and he stays at home at her beck and call. And so now he's not alone anymore. He's got somebody in his life who appreciates it. Somewhere, I'm saying, in society, there is almost a desirable place because there is so much of a prevalence of this role play, of the dominant submissive role play, you know? A large number, I'm telling you, we're talking about 20 to 25% of the people are somewhere actively involved in this dominant submissive role play.
Remember the story of the salesman who was curing the problem and he had this homosexual gratification? When he takes a trip to New York, he goes to see a dominatrix. And the reason is because the dominatrix is very skilled, and she is able to facilitate his expression of what is shameful material, and he feels that he is able to cleanse himself.
Well, as I've and all the work that I've done with people who have social phobia, it usually uncovers a great private sexual life. Great, enormous fantasy life. Either on the internet, you could have all this sexual fantasy, huge amounts of masturbation, lots of it. People, you know, bringing themselves to orgasm, living in the house of shame and living it in their own mind. I mean, it's the only place that they're safe with their sexuality. When somebody has a sexuality that they consider to be unacceptable by everyone else, and they can't find someone to embrace it. Let's say the one who wants to be a slave can't find the master. So they create that in their own home, and they create that in their own isolation.
And there's one other key. The internet is the vehicle these days because they don't have to expose themselves. They can remain anonymous. That's why we have an addiction within an addiction, the computer as a component of the addiction to avoidance.
You have people lying about who they are. They are creating stories about who they are and talking to other people, but they can make up any story they want.
And now we can have avoidant sex.
And what is avoidant sex?
Sex without – not in person. It's cyber sex, real sexual relationships without real intimacy.
Which is part of the threat. When I went through the book, one of the things I noticed absolutely missing in it, Jonathan, was this thing about people's sexuality. You know, the detail of the sexuality at home.
You know, I was writing a second book a few years ago. It was called Sex in the 21st Century. Mm-hmm. I was covering it then, but I didn't get it published.
Somewhere in here, there's a it gets kind of difficult because, you know, the socially anxious adult has, in their adultness, there is so much going on. It's so difficult. But the one thing we know is they won't go for treatment. If they do go for treatment, inadvertently, they run into a physician. And what does the physician do? The physician prescribes medication. Right? And the medication of choice is always, I'm sure, the SSRIs, right? Is that right, Jonathan?
That is correct.
They will put them on Zoloft.
A couple of years ago, the FDA gave approval for Paxil for the treatment of severe shyness. We're now bombarded by commercials. The good stuff about these commercials is that people can self-diagnose. They know what they have for the first time. The bad component, and I think there's a lot of clinically criminal behavior going on, is that a lot of people feel that a pill is the cure. It's not. In my practice, where we have about 125 people a week coming in, 30% are on medicine. The vast majority are not. And we only give meds when the depression and anxiety are overwhelming or obsessive characteristics are debilitating. And it's wonderful if when the medicine creates a sense of ease in the brain so that we can get to the underlying issues. If not, more often than not, it's a dysfunctional approach. It goes like this. It is a psychophysiological phenomenon. The person who has a panic attack and who has these physical symptoms thinks, oh, my God, I've got these symptoms. There's something medical going on. I need a pill. They go to the doctor. What they're not understanding is that step one is thinking. Step two is emotions. Step three is it turns into physiology. And if you're really going to cure something, you have to approach those dynamics sequentially. The trick in prescribing this medication is that you have to really understand the chemistry of the person. Some people need more energy. Some people need less energy. But you're bringing up – you're making me think of something else. Everybody with social phobia has rage and anger. They may not be aware of it, and sometimes they cannot grasp this concept clinically. One of the sad things that we see lately is in school violence. What's the pattern with these kids? They're picked on and they're loners. Not everybody, but that's the pattern. These kids are exploding with their anger. The typical person with social anxiety and social phobia and severe shyness is imploding. They're repressing. So it turns into panic, obsession, and depression.
And that is where that's why people would prescribe the SSRIs. Of course, there are other things you could do, which Jonathan will talk about and we'll talk about. Adult warning signs for the socially anxious adult, or the warning signs. I'm going to read them, Jonathan. Lack of peer relationships outside the family. Now, that's kind of important, lack of peer activities outside the family. Think about how many friends you have. That's it. If you don't have friends, you might be a social phobe. Feelings of guilt or shame that are prevalent. Difficulty with social skills such as keeping a conversation going. Difficulty with intimacy in relationships. Sense of being different, alienated from others. Drug or alcohol dependency, and by the way, one of the biggest signs of it is the overuse of drugs and alcohol. It's like one of the places where you could move to finally feel safe. You know, that's what people use it as. Feelings of loneliness, depression, suicidal thoughts, quick temper, difficulty making or keeping friends, devastating reaction to rejection, fear of humiliation. A sense of reality as black or white is this tendency which we're going to talk about. Distorted body image, a picture of yourself as being distorted in some kind of way. Anxiety attacks, especially in social situations, difficulty making decisions, anxiety reactions in restaurants, banks, and movies, persistent difficulty with job and career, sexual identity problems. Physical complaints, hypochondria, self-destructive behaviors, stress-related physical symptoms, and fear of groups. Now, take a look at these symptoms and imagine if you said, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, that's me, as you're sitting at home listening on your radio, not planning to go out anywhere today, you may be somebody who is socially anxious. And this is something we're going to deal with. There are two symptoms in here that very interest me, Jonathan, and I know you've done some work with it. First thing I want to talk about is loneliness. I mean, what a profound loneliness it must be. Or do you talk yourself out of it? Do you build your little family and you just make believe you're living with a new family?
Yes, there's a lot of delusional material, but I remember an article in the New York Times about 15 years ago that said there's more research demonstrated there's more distress associated with loneliness than with smoking cigarettes. And people, but we're talking about a disease of adaptation. And people with social anxiety are the world's best experts at manipulating to avoid what is threatening. They will do anything to do this avoidance, and hence comes the loneliness, which obviously breeds depression and a myriad of other problems.
Hmm. There's a the other one I'm interested in is perfectionism. But let's talk about it. I mean, perfectionist is one of those ways, one of those adaptations that many people have in life. But here's my question. It would seem natural that perfectionists can easily become social phobes?
Exactly. The reality is that we're talking
Did you say exactly as a pun? Exactly.
I wasn't conscious of it. To be good in anything, a person needs experience, whether it's business, relationships, sports. In order to perform, you have to learn from mistakes. The person who is hypersensitive to making mistakes can't get on the playing field or stage of life and therefore does not have the opportunity. And it's amazing seeing these people who are socially anxious involved in such thinking that if I'm not perfect at it, if I'm not good at it from the get-go, I can't do it because it's shameful. The result of very toxic messages.
So perfectionism is one of those ways in life that will lead you to hiding out forever.
It's one component of this.
Shame. What is all this shame about? Why are they living with shame? It's such a horrendous part of this. It is really believing, and shame is such an important part of the perfectionist. You're right. I could think of a couple of people who are public figures, And in their home, they have a very controlled environment. They invite people up to their house for a brief moment, for a brief interaction, usually for sexual play. They send them away. Then they have all these locks on their door, and people come in. Now, they go out, and this is a person who is publicly active, or people who are publicly active, but they live a life of absolute privacy. They don't feel the loneliness. You see, they feel the loneliness by having these momentary sexual interactions. You know, they'll call somebody, if you want to come over tonight, you know, boom, come on over. And then they send them away. And they keep in this isolated, I don't let the world in. I've known these people to actually get to the point where they'll be afraid to open the windows because they're afraid bugs are going to come in.
Well, there's a thin line between social anxiety and paranoia. And there are a lot of people who do very well in structured situations where they're in control, but you put them in spontaneous environments, and that's where the anxiety kicks in.
So you don't see the social anxiety because they look public.
Mm-hmm.
They look public. They look like they're out there. But it could be somebody who's all the way out there and in many ways living this socially phobic life.
But here's a typical example. One of my patients could be on the cover of GQ magazine. He's a salesman. He's a very attractive guy, dresses meticulously, has his nails done once a week, goes to the gym 5 times a week, is looking at himself in the mirror all the time, creates a fantastic image. But before he leaves the house to go to a singles-oriented environment, he's got to have 6 drinks. Because of the pathological self-esteem and propensity to panic. One of the characteristics for which is probably the most common in terms of adults is conversational skills. People saying, I don't know how to keep a conversation going, and they refuse to understand that it's really the result of anxiety. The reality is that they do have thoughts in their mind, but they choose not to risk. They choose not to share. They censor themselves, and they interpret it as they don't know what to say when that's really not the truth.
You know, when you think of hypersexuality on many people's parts, as far as being satiriasis or being out there having a lot of sex, you know, the part of the thing you might be doing is dealing with the inability to have a conversation. There are a lot of people who could get together, and they don't know how to talk. Boom, so I have sex. That's going to do it. That's going to solve the problem, the only way of communicating. Armand DeMille here with Jonathan Berent. Now, Jonathan has a couple of things that they offer. They have a self-test, which you can get somehow. What do they do?
Yes, it's a number of self-assessment tools to help define the intensity of the problem in terms of social skills, anxiety, dependence, avoidance. You can get this at no cost by doing a search on the internet for socialanxiety.com.
Jonathan, one more thing about your approach, from what I hear, is behaviorist. You're generally going to help people correct their behaviors and understand what's underneath all of these. You're not strictly behaviorist, because I know part of your symptom, part of what you're going to do is help people identify the stressor, identify the cause, identify their choices, setting priorities, but it's basically a behavioral approach.
Well, when a person is working clinically, there are 3 parallel processes: behavioral. You have to get out of your comfort zone. Number 2, which I think is the most important, is doing the deep emotional work. And number 3 is a lot of these people have autonomic hypersensitivity. That's where we've got to take a look at the physiological aspects of things.
All 3 of them. And you do
right.
All 3?
All
you do
3.
The deep intentional, deep intense. Yesterday we had a man on the program, Gene Genlin, who said part of the problem with trying to treat certain disorders is that you get stuck in the emotional all too often, that you don't get underneath it, because when you get to the emotional layer, like terror, you could just hang out in that much too long. And if you hang out in that too long, you don't get underneath it.
Right, but we got to get past the obsessive tendencies there, and the only way there can be a high degree of resolution is to do that deep emotional work, in my book.
Good. What kind of deep emotional work, like Gestalt work, or...
Well, without putting a label on it, it's taking the person into the process of how they learned the humiliation and embarrassment, to be able to really understand that it's a learned phenomenon, and to help them manage their ego states, their personality states, when they are in a stressful situation. If you can have acceptance of the panic and roll with the punch, or surf the wave, if you will, and roll with it, the physics, the energy will not be as intense. That's a very important thing. But when you talk about the most important tip for social phobics, it goes like this. Your most valuable asset in life is not your bank account. It's time. And people who have this problem mistake that time is finite. It's not elastic. It doesn't stretch. You've got to take action now and make time your friend instead of your enemy.
Well, I kind of get what you're saying. You're saying that that people should hurry up and do this?
Well, we're fighting, I'll wait. Next week, next year,
and
that's
it always
the nature.
And it's additive, like you said. Every time you wait, you kind of add to the resistance.
Right, and when parents see the patterns of social avoidance in the 6-year-old or the 16-year-old, don't make the mistake of thinking that the child is going to grow out of it. You've got to take action.
You know, in many ways, social phobia is like addiction. You know, in many ways, it has to be treated like addiction. You got to take an action on it. Here's a last question. We're running out of time. Would it be – if you had a social phobic who was just wanted to be public in some kind of way but just wanted to get out there, you know, one of the ways I've seen people do is they go to AA meetings or NA meetings, which are open meetings where a person could go and sit in virtually in the back of a room and be around a bunch of people. Now, I don't know if the AA people or the NA people would resent people using them that way, but I really think social phobia is an addiction in its own kind of way. You get addicted to a way of being. Could you go, would you advise, or what do you think? Do you think that people go into an NA meeting just to sit there so they could be around humans?
But most social phobes can't get to the group. And what a lot of people don't understand is the nature of individual support that is even necessary to help a person be involved in group therapy. People think, well, you're socially phobic, let's go to a group. They don't understand how difficult it is for the person to get to the group.
So that's where your program comes in. That's what you've got a number of people who work with you, who work with social phobic people, right, Jonathan? And they help them take the step, whatever it is.
Through a combination of individual, group, and family therapy.
Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI. We're going to have to be leaving you at this moment. We're going to have to be leaving you, unfortunately. I wish we had more time. www.socialanxiety.com is the name of the website for Jonathan Berendt. Thank you very much for being with us, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org or you can go to thepositivemind.com where you'll hear a lot of archives. And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reactions. Be back with you soon, my friends.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she baited for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said,
get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pulled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called the doctor, woke him up, said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can.
Hey there, friends, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Having been a little under the weather, as we all have, huh? Well, help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the Buddy System. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org, Buddy. Make a difference.
Call me in the morning, woo. Ain't there nothing you can